All right, good evening, everybody. This is Alex Dolan, and I'm filling in for Pam Stack for Authors on the Air. I am really pleased to be joined by Mark Edwards, who is a fantastic writer, and I am here to help him promote The Devil's Work. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me on.
And I think that to get started, we talked a little bit about what to talk about going into this, and you had mentioned that you had kind of an interesting story about how you came to writing. So let's talk about that first.
Oh wow, that is a very long story. So I have to tell
we'll suck up half the hour just on that.
Yeah. So it's I'm in my mid 40s now, and I started writing when I was in my early 20s, and I went through the whole thing for years of trying to get an agent and trying to get a publisher and never quite made it. And then I teamed up with a friend called Louise Voss, and we started writing novels together. We wrote a book called Killing Cupid. This was back in the early 2000s, and we got it optioned by the BBC, but never actually... it never got made. We never got a publishing deal. Then we wrote another book called Catch Your Death. Again, we couldn't get a publisher. This is really the very truncated version of this long story. So I've covered 15 years in about 15 seconds. And then in 2010, I got a Kindle. The Kindle was launched in the UK. And along with it, Amazon launched their direct publishing scheme, KDP. And so I said to Louise, why don't we self-publish these books? Seeing as we've written them and no one's ever going to read them unless we do something about it. And she was very reluctant and thought we'd sell about two copies. But we did. We went for it. We self-published them. And after months of kind of frenetic marketing of these books and trying to spread the word about them and picking up really good reviews, they hit number one and number two on the Amazon UK chart. We were the first independent British authors to do that, to get to number one. So that then brought us loads of attention, because this was like the first wave of self-published authors becoming successful. We were on TV, we were in all the newspapers, we got an agent, and then we got a four book deal with HarperCollins in the UK. And this was in 2011, like I said, and I thought, I mean, this was after like 15 years of trying to get a deal, and finally I had a publishing deal and had a hit and thought, well, it's going to be easy from now on. But it wasn't. What happened next was that the books that were published by Harper didn't do as well as anybody hoped. The first one, Catch Your Death, kind of did okay, but then they just sold fewer and fewer as time went on, to the point where when the fourth book in the deal came out, we knew it wasn't going to be stocked by any stores. And the publisher had completely lost interest in us, and we're about to kind of write us off as a bad decision. And so this is 2013, and I had taken the gamble, which some writers do, when I got the deal, of quitting my day job, thinking I was going to be a full-time writer. And by 2013, I was in serious financial difficulty, where I didn't have a secure job anymore. I was doing some freelance work. I had a huge tax bill looming, sort of hanging over me. My wife was pregnant with our third child, and I was having sleepless nights, and kind of I'm laughing about it now because it kind of turned out okay, as I'm about to say, but it was a very dark time. And I then decided to self-publish a solo book, which I'd had kind of knocking around for a long time, which is called The Magpies. And I thought, well, if I've done it before, maybe I can do it again, without any real expectations, because by that point, self-publishing had got much harder. It was so much more competitive. And the big publishers had kind of figured out how to sell ebooks, and it wasn't going to be anywhere near as easy. But luckily for me, the Magpies really took off. Again, it got to number one in the UK, and has gone on to sell now just over 500,000 copies. So that success with the Magpies led to me then getting a deal with Amazon Publishing and Thomas and Mercer, and they've published my next. I've actually lost count of it for the four books, and plus two more with Louise, so it's six in total. And I'm now making a good living as a full-time writer. I'm supporting my family doing it, which is amazing. It's been a bit of a roller coaster the last few years, but at the moment things are going really well. I can spin that tale out for an hour, but you've got the very short version.
No, this is really good. You know, you're reminding me of, there's a horror author that I interviewed on my show, and her name's Anya Alborn. And okay. She had a similar story where she had her first book was called Seed. I think it was about possession. And it just was a runaway hit. She self-published, and that it springboarded her into a huge book deal, and she's doing really well right now. Yeah. And so one of the questions I asked her was, which I'm curious for you as a sort of a self-publishing success story, do you have a sense of what made the book take off?
The first one, the ones that I did with Louise, I think that it was a combination of kind of a lot of hours. I mean, I put in a lot of hours. I was putting in 3 or 4 hours a day on top of doing a full-time day job and having kids. Like every evening I was on my laptop doing lots of, I was mainly blogging. I didn't do hardly anything on Twitter or Facebook at that time. It was mainly blogging, and I thought that if I could, because the difficulty, there are so many millions of books out there, self-published and traditionally published, that getting noticed is the hard thing. And regardless of how good the book is or how good the cover is or whatever, you've got to get it. You've got to let people know it exists. So my strategy was to, I knew that there were a lot of people who had new Kindles who were looking for new authors and who were open to buying self-published books. So my strategy was to kind of find the readers of the other big self-published authors. So I did a lot of interviews and Q&As with other authors' blogs. I had my own blog where I was interviewing like the other big self-published authors, and then trying to bring their readers to find out to my website to know to find out that I existed, and that kind of, and very, very slowly the sales kind of grew from, I don't know, 3 or 4 copies a day up to 50 a day, and then 100 a day, and then eventually like 1,000 a day when we were number one. And we made sure we had a really good cover, and I also used to really tweak the description. So, you know, you have like the blurb or the book description on Amazon.
Right.
I would be constantly tweaking that and rewriting it, because in those days you used to be able to see what percentage of people who visited your page were then going on to buy it. You can't do that anymore, but Amazon used to put that stat on the page. And I could see that our conversion rate from people visiting the page to buying the book was quite low, or lower than a lot of the other books that were doing well. So I was content, and then I rewrote it, and I literally doubled sales almost immediately from having a much better description, a simpler description that kind of described the book in a more straightforward way, and from there it just kind of took off. And once you're in the charts and people and you become visible, then if you've got a good cover and a good description and good reviews, then it hopefully continue to climb. And then with the Magpies, which came out 2 years later, I got a boost from the fact that I already had an existing readership, and lots of them went out and bought it as soon as it came out, all on the same day, which sent it high enough up the charts for it to kind of then be noticed by other people. And from there, it kind of kept climbing and climbing and climbing.
I'm the most fascinated with what happens between the selling 3 a day and selling 100 a day. Because it feels like after that, once you actually get a certain amount of visibility, you can the momentum can build on itself. But I think for a lot of authors, it's harder to transcend that initial obscurity of trying to just cut through the clutter to try to get to. Yeah.
I just did everything that I could think of to try and get. Every sale was an effort at that point. And I was like a man possessed trying to get people to know about the book. And there were certain things like getting a review on some of the larger blogs that were kind of reviewing indie books, things like that, you'd see a bit of a boost, or doing an interview on another author's website, or one of the more popular authors who did a lot of social media. And it was just from kind of doing the amount of energy that I poured into it. I felt like it was almost like the amount of energy that I was using was propelling the book up the charts, which sounds absurd. you can't just do that, but I was doing everything that I could think of to try and sell it.
So it sounds like this was the aggregate impact of doing a lot of things at once.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily one hit, one, you know, that really drove everything.
No, apart from changing that description, which was the thing that made the difference once people were visiting the page, there wasn't really anything that there wasn't one big thing. With the Magpies, I know that it was that Amazon sent out an email to the people who bought my previous books, and that made a big difference. But that was once I already had an existing audience, and now my audience is much bigger. So every time a new book comes out, and people find out about it, they kind of will take off. Luckily, I'm touching wood now straight away. But I don't actually do barely any marketing these days. All I do is I've got a Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter, and I've got an email list, and I just kind of communicate with my existing readers, and I think that's the most important thing. I mean, I get a lot of emails and tweets and Facebook messages from people, and I always respond. I put a lot of effort into kind of nurturing that relationship with my readers, because they're so important, and they're the people who will recommend you to their friends. And there's always so many new authors coming along, like all the time. Keeping readers loyal, which you can do obviously by keep writing great books, but I think that having a relationship with your readers is really important as well. And that's one of the great things about the 21st century, is that you can do that. I can't imagine what it must have been like in the olden days when you might have actually got letters in the mail and had to kind of write back, and it was all very slow, and you never got reviews unless you were reviewed in the newspaper or a magazine or something. Things are so different now than they must have been like 20, 30 years ago. I can't imagine what it must have been like.
I agree. Well, for people that are just coming to your work for the first time, and I'll say this for people, we're talking to Mark Edwards. The book that we're going to get to, the book that he's just releasing, is called The Devil's Work. But we're leading up to that, and a lot of people, I'm sure, are familiar and have read a lot of your books already. But let's talk about The Magpies to give people a flavor of what the books are about. Talk about what that book is about.
Well, The Magpies is about neighbors from hell. Most of my books can be described in three words, but two of which are always from hell. So, Magpies is Neighbours from Hell, and it was influenced by something that really happened to me, which was that I used to live above this horrendous couple who did everything that they could to make my then girlfriend's life miserable. Everything from standard stuff like banging on the ceiling and they used to write us really nasty letters, and they used to put cigarette butts under our door and send us like hoax parcels in the mail, and just kind of trivial stuff, but it went on for so long that it kind of made us feel really uncomfortable in our flat. And after I moved out, I thought, how could I kind of take that scenario and make it really scary? Or what would I have done if things had got really, really bad? And that was the starting point of that book. So you've got a young couple just moved into their first home together, and they want to kind of settle down and have a family, and they find out that they basically moved in next to a couple of psychopaths who do everything they can to destroy their happy lives. And it's a kind of relentless stream of horrible things happening to this poor mother.
Well, all right. So in the real life with you and your then girlfriend and these horrible people, two questions. What was the worst thing in real life that happened between you? And do you have a sense of what sparked this weird feud?
Well, I think I think it was that they just didn't want to have people living above them. They were the kind of people who would only be happy living in a remote cottage out in the middle of the countryside. So living in a basement flat where there's always going to be people kind of walking around above their heads, they just couldn't handle it. I think they were the same with the people who lived there before us. And they were probably like...
But it wasn't like you guys were flamenco dancing at midnight or something.
The thing is, we weren't noisy. We weren't like revving motorbikes outside, and we weren't playing the drums or jumping around. But there wasn't any one particular thing that they did that was really, really horrendous. It was just lots of very small things. The most annoying thing was the fact that they used to send us all these hoax parcels, usually like piles of books. Like sticking cigarette butts under our front door, and they just come around and kind of scream at us. And the guy was quite a big, intimidating, muscular kind of guy, and about 10 years older than me. And he was quite scary, actually. He kind of had that look, you know, like a kind of great white shark, the kind of dead eye.
did his eyes roll back in his head while he ate something? you're reminding me the worst.
They're in his mouth.
I had a friend who had a similar situation with his next door neighbor, and it was sort of the funniest passive aggressive thing I've ever heard about in this scenario. Was they to get back at him? They ordered the kind of the filthiest, horrible pornographic fetish magazine they could, but then had it delivered not to him, but to his other next door neighbor. So they had to walk it over every month, and that was their passive aggressive way of getting back at them.
Right.
All right, so let's move forward to follow you home. So by your convention of the three-word title with From Hell in it, this would be the vacation from hell.
Yes. Or holiday from hell in the UK. But yeah, vacation from hell.
So holiday from hell. And this also is inspired by real-life experience.
Yeah, it was. So again, this was actually when I was younger than the magpie thing. It was when I was about 19 or 20, I went... interrailing or euro railing So you buy like a ticket which gives you a free pass around Europe. And this is with another ex-girlfriend. all of my books involve either past or present girlfriends or wives. We basically got robbed on our second day in Europe. We were on a train from Paris to Avignon in South France. And we were in a private compartment, which, I mean, all of those trains are private compartments. And we fell asleep. And when we woke up, all of our stuff, all of our money, our passports, our traveler's check, it was gone. And I don't remember kind of falling asleep. It was just kind of like one of those things where you just like black out and then come to. It feels like a second later. We found out later that people were going through trains in France at that time and gassing travelers. And so gassing them until they passed out and then just going through the train and stealing all their possessions.
What gas would they use?
I don't know, some kind of sleeping gas. I'm not sure. I mean, I tried to Google it since, because this is pre-internet, but I did a talk in a prison recently, and I was talking about this, and there were some guys kind of nodding like, yeah, that used to go on loads like 20, 30 years ago in Europe. Anyway, I ended up, we were stranded in the south of France with no money, and we ended up having to hitchhike home from the very south of France after spending like a night on the floor of Marseille Station, which is probably the scariest place in the world. In the middle of the night, there were like people trying to tempt us to kind of come with us. Like, yeah, they're going to lock us up and make us be in a porn film. It was really scary.
That's usually how the story ends.
Yeah. So again, because I did the Magpies and then I did Because She Loves Me, which was about another thing that happened to me, which is when I had a really, really jealous girlfriend who kind of made my life hell. And my editor at Amazon said, oh, you need to find another horrible thing that happened to you in the past that you can turn into a story. And I was like, oh yeah, I could use that one with the trip from hell. So in Follow You Home, you've got, again, a young couple kind of having their final adventure before they're going to settle down. And they get onto a train in Hungary, which goes across the border into Romania. And something happens on the train and they end up getting kicked off the train in the middle of nowhere and have to walk along this disused railway track through the forest. With a Romanian girl that they've met on the train, and they end up going into this forest, and there's this house in the middle of the trees, and they see something in this house, and they flee. You don't find out what they've seen until kind of halfway through the book, and as the title goes, this something follows them home. So it's a psychological thriller, but it starts off like a kind of classic horror movie where you've got people going into the woods and there's a kind of scary house in the woods, Blair Witch style, kind of that primeval fear that we all have of like being in the woods at night. And I loved writing those early chapters where they're walking through the dark woods. All of my favorite horror movies from I've watched over like the last 20 years, I kind of used all of that as an influence.
That's a structure that always appeals to me. You know, I think that for me, the thing that would be even scarier about The Vacation from Hell when you were taking it is now if you run into horrible people and you're possibly abducted on vacation, there is a remote chance that Liam Neeson will save you. But back in your 20s, there was no Liam Neeson and you were on your own and you had to get yourself out of your own pickle.
Yeah. And you couldn't even tweet. You couldn't like send off a quick tweet or something saying, oh,
right, right. Hashtag help me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember having to use phone boxes and phone cards. Do you remember those? have like
All right, well, so this, so we have, well, we started out, so we started out, we have the holiday from hell, and now we're going to move forward to the devil's work, which is the job from hell.
Yeah, the office from hell, yeah, all the jobs.
So talk about the new book.
Okay, so, yeah, as you said, it's about the job from hell. So it's about a woman called Sophie who's in her 30s. She has been on a kind of extended maternity leave, raising her daughter, and she goes back to work now that her daughter's 4 and is starting school. And she goes to work at a publishing house, and it's the place that Sophie has always dreamed of working, like ever since she was a little girl. It's a children's publisher. And she has a connection to this company through somebody that she was best friends with at university. So the book kind of goes between the present day with Sophie starting her new job and the past when she was friends with this girl who was the granddaughter of the owner of this company called Jackdaw Books. And there's something in Sophie's past which is going to come back to bite her, which becomes gradually revealed as the book goes on. But as Sophie starts the job, all this weird stuff starts happening to her, and it gradually gets worse and worse and darker, and she can't work out whether she's being paranoid. Is it she's got this kind of assistant, this young woman called Cassie, who was my favourite character to write because she's a very a character that people really love to hate because she does all this stuff to seemingly sabotage Sophie, and she's really ambitious and kind of quite passive aggressive and is what Sophie doesn't know is Cassie out to get her or is something worse going on? And this book was really, really hard to write. It's by far the hardest of the books that I've written because of the interweaving timelines, and it's got a really complex plot, and trying to get this all to work was a real challenge. I was literally rolling on the floor, banging my head against the carpet, kind of weeping with despair at some points because it was so difficult. But I got there in the end, and I think it's my best book, and the reviews have been really, really good, and I describe it to people as The Devil Wears Prada rewritten by Stephen King. And that's kind of that's what I was going for. That kind of office setting, a young woman kind of facing all these struggles in an office, but with loads of really scary stuff going on as well.
Well, let's talk about the setting because it's such, you know, one of the things that intrigues me about your other books is that you talk about, I really like the fact that you're basically putting people in jeopardy and in situations that most people can relate to. Although, on a side note, I think it's interesting you did a talk in prison, and it would be interesting to see how much they related to the ultimate holiday in hell and things like that, that they may not have direct experience with that kind of holiday. But it sounds like, you know, you take these very common experiences that we all have and you know, the question is what would happen if that was suddenly dangerous for you. But I don't, you know, The Office seems like a perfection for something like this. And I don't read many books that are set in an office that take a psychological thriller angle to that kind of setting. Why did you choose that?
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, there's very few psychological thrillers set in offices. The only other one I can think of is When She Was Bad by Tammy Cohen, which came out around the same time as mine. And I don't know why that is, but I decided to write a book set in an office because, well, you've kind of captured my way of working perfectly, because that's what I do. I try to come up with an ordinary situation that people can identify, whether it's having bad neighbours or a relationship or a holiday, and take that and make scary things happen. So when I was, after I'd finished Folly at Home, and I was thinking, well, where am I going to set my next book? The office work seemed to be the obvious thing. Because I'd worked in offices for, well, ever since I was in my early 20s, so like over 20 years. And like everybody, I'd had my fair share of psychotic bosses and nightmarish colleagues and office politics and gossip and backbiting and the way there's a fascinating thing about work is that when you're in that environment, everything is exaggerated and seems so important and so big well, if you eventually leave that job, you just kind of like forget about it almost instantly. But when you're there in the high drama of a tense work situation, you think it's the worst thing ever. So yeah, to me it seemed like a perfect place to set a thriller, and I'm amazed that there aren't more thrillers set in offices. Maybe people don't want to read books that are that familiar, that are set somewhere where they probably spend most of their lives and they don't want to be. I might have made a terrible mistake writing a book written in an office, I don't know. But
I kind of wonder. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, you get a lot of books and TV dramas set in places like lawyers' offices, for example.
Right.
Where it's a bit glamorous and you've always got like the case of the week or something to kind of keep sticking along. But and you've obviously got thousands and thousands of books set in police headquarters or police stations, and that's a workplace, and you always have all the politics going on between the cops and stuff. But again, you've got the crime, you've got the glamour of the solving the crime. So but yeah, I think that the reception of the book has been very good. So obviously there is an appetite out there for psychological thriller set in offices, and it was a lot of fun to, even though it was so hard to write, it was a lot of fun kind of creating this workplace and making all these terrible things. I really like torturing my characters, trying to, you turn the screw and make things worse and worse for them.
I think that's sort of the cover charge for entry for any psychological thriller, is putting your characters in horrible situations. But you're reminding me, I wanted to riff off this, you know, you're reminding me that one of the, I was trying to think of books that were set in an office that would be a psychological thriller, and I was thinking of something like American Psycho, which you have his personal life. I mean, basically the book is kind of split between his personal life and the office, but and it's a very different kind of book. But one of the things I like about having things set in the office is that it's all about your motivations are so different than your motivations would be at home, or if you were on holiday. And, you know, at home you have things like love and affection and family, and those are things that are really important. And if you're on holiday, if you're walking through the woods and you're basically venturing into the unknown, there's something that's very primal about survival, and that maybe that's what's motivating you. But the thing about that, for me, it's interesting about The Office, it's all about your own credibility and your own status and your own sense of purpose, and that's like these higher psychological motivations, which are no less important sometimes than the other stuff. And definitely with American Psycho, part of what Bret Easton Ellis played with that book in the work setting is really like all the perception of how important he wanted to be, and how that was a huge motivator in the office. And, you know, cause I would think that would be something that would be interesting to play around with.
Yeah. I love that book. It's one of my favorite books. I went to see Bret Easton Ellis do a talk about American Psycho a few years ago in London. It was so, so fascinating. He's so clever, the the wit in that book is astounding. But I mean, I can think of another book. Do you know the writer Jason Starr?
The name's book, familiar, but I've never read anything by him.
He's brilliant. He writes kind of, well, they are like psychological thrillers. And his first one was called Cold Caller, which is about a guy who works in a call center and all this terrible stuff starts happening to him at work. And you have a kind of subgenre, which I kind of think of as like executive in peril, like the early Joseph Finder book,
mm-hmm.
Where you have some kind of white collar worker who gets into some kind of, usually through some kind of corporate double dealing or something, gets into loads of trouble. They're slightly different to the psychological thrillers, but yeah, that's a definite subgenre. But yeah, you're right. It's all to do with like your status and power and money as well. Actually, I had to, because somebody can quit. One of the challenges for me with this book was that people might be thinking, well, why doesn't she just quit?
Why don't they just quit, yeah.
Just resign. Because that's what you do if work's terrible. But you have to have a firm reason why you can't quit. And often it's, well, I need the job. I need the money. It's easy to find another job. But also it's kind of, the character in the book, Sophie, wants to prove to herself that she's up to it, and she's got all these kind of voices whispering to her that you're not good enough, and she wants to prove that she is good enough and that she can show people that she is. So yeah, and it's like we were saying, it is just a great setting because you've got all of that psychological drama going on, and it is so familiar to people.
And I think it's, you know, the thing about the workplace is, as in real life, there's the question of how much will you put up with. And
yeah.
It's an exercise where, you know, it's not necessarily about survival or about getting something you want. It's about how much torture are you willing to endure
yeah.
in that situation.
I know.
So I have an idea for another book. So I was thinking, like, of all the things. So you've tackled vacation, you've tackled neighbors, so your home life, and you've tackled the job. And I was thinking it would be good to, like, find, if you were to go to, say, Starbucks on your way to work, and have that be the cafe from hell. And the title, I've already picked out the title. It is Dark Grounds.
Oh, very good.
I know. It writes itself, doesn't it?
I know, yeah. I know. But that's not dark enough.
Actually, I think it's brilliant that you've been able to encapsulate all of your books in three words. I would kill to be able to do that.
The trouble is, the next one, I can't. I've shot myself in the foot, because the next one, I haven't actually figured out how to describe it in even 12 words or 15 words yet, because it's not an X from Hell novel.
Are you at liberty to talk about it now?
Yeah, I can. I mean, like I said, I haven't practiced at all, because I'm still editing it. I haven't even completely finished it yet. But it's called The Lucky Ones, and the idea is basically that good things start happening to people, like people have great fortune, but unknown to them, they are being manipulated by someone who is trying to make them happy so that he can kill them when they're at their happiest moment.
Okay.
That is the premise. So it's a serial killer novel about a serial killer who's trying to make his victims happy.
And then kill them at the pinnacle of their happiness.
Yeah, exactly. Kill them with a smile on their face.
Okay.
And so you've got, and it's set in the countryside in England, in like a beautiful setting near where I live, and a kind of horror in paradise kind of thing. But it's a psychological thriller in that you've got the main guy who kind of starts the book at his lowest ebb. Like, his wife's had an affair, he's a single parent, he's lost his job, so all the bad stuff has already happened and his mum's dying of cancer. Like, there's all this terrible stuff is happening to him, and then it starts to get better. They suddenly have great luck, and unknown to him, it's because he's being targeted by this serial killer who is terrorizing the county. So it was quite a challenge, because normally in my books I have bad things happening to people and you kind of have the tension, the growing tension from that. So that the challenge of this book was to build tension with good things
coming
happening
right
to people.
I found something on the web about county, because normally in my books I have bad things happening to pay attention.
Oh my God, Siri has just kind of sprung.
Siri has just weighed in on this. I was hoping Siri would weigh in with a three-letter synopsis, three-word synopsis for you. Mine would just be happiness from hell. But it doesn't quite work. And I'd say, whoever's listening, if you know, I'm going to put it out there. If anyone has a three-word description for Mark's new book, then you can let us know. And I should let people know that if anyone's listening wants to call in and talk to Mark, whether you're based in the UK or in the US, this is a great opportunity. He is a wonderful writer, and I'll give you the call-in number. It's 347-633-9609. I'm going to take a quick announcement break, and I'm going to give the number one more time, 347-633-9609. I want to remind everybody that you're listening to Authors on the Air. We are a global radio network of about 3 million listeners, and welcome to Mark Edwards. This is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am Alex Dolan. I'm filling in for Pam Stack. And Pam, if you are listening, I hope you are feeling better, and we welcome you back pretty soon. We're talking to Mark Edwards, who is the author of several books, including The Magpies, Follow You Home, and the new one, The Devil's Work. And we were talking about the new one. Does the new one have a working title yet?
Yeah, it's called The Lucky Ones.
Oh, I like that.
So,
I think I've seen it. When is that coming out? I think that title sounds familiar.
It's probably someone else has done it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it hasn't been promoted anywhere, in June. The title has been done before, but not in this genre. So I kind of thought it's okay. I can use it.
Let's go back to The Devil's Work for 1 second. So you haven't worked in an office for a little while, and I wanted to talk to you about your previous job. So you've taught in Japan.
Yeah.
And so when were you there?
2002. I was there when the World Cup was on, which was amazing. So I was only there for a year. I was there 2002 to 2003, and I was teaching English conversation, which basically involves sitting in a little booth with usually three people just chatting, basically. It was really, it was kind of easy. It wasn't real teaching.
Did you like Japan?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. Yeah, it was amazing. It's such a alien kind of, compared to England, it's so different. You get such a culture shock when you go there, especially because it was Tokyo, which is where I was living. And the people are so nice, and I love the culture. I love Japanese culture. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to go there is because I've always been like a huge fan of Haruki Murakami and kind of books like that. And I love Japanese horror films as well. I had a very good reason for wanting to go to live in Japan. So,
Haruki Murakami is one of my all-time favorite writers. I'd say he's a top five for me.
Yeah, me too.
I did absolutely love him. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was great kind of going to kind of see the places where he'd set his books. And yeah, it's a great country, but I wish I'd stayed there for longer, but I kind of had to get back to the UK and kind of start. It was like a career break, really, between jobs. I got made redundant and had a little bit of money and thought, well, why not go and do something that I'm not going to get the chance to do again when I start having kids and so on. So I just did it for a year, but it was fantastic.
So when you were in Japan, was that what gave you your love of karaoke?
Yes.
Oh, was it? Was it actually? Was that the?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I went to, because it's so different in Japan than it is in. I don't know what it's like in the US, but in the UK, it used to be that karaoke would be standing on a stage in front of like a bar full of people. Whereas in Japan, you have the private karaoke booths, and that was like a revelation. I can honestly say that some of my happiest nights of my life, probably 3 or 4 out of the top 10 best nights of my life, have been doing karaoke in Japan. I just absolutely loved it. We'd get like a big group of people together, like teachers and like the Japanese staff that we had, and drink loads and loads and loads of Japanese beer and lock ourselves in a karaoke booth for about 4 or 5 hours. And it was really, it was just really great fun. And now you've got quite a lot of karaoke booth places in London as well. Only 2 weeks ago, I went out with a group of other crime writers, and did karaoke with them. And that was really good fun as well.
I live in San Francisco, and there's a section of San Francisco called Japantown. And it was a long time ago, I went to a karaoke booth place, and it was the first time I'd ever been into one. And I had the same experience where it was just me and friends, and we brought our own beer and liquor, and we're in there for 4 hours, and it was a blast. It was so much fun. So much different than standing up in front of strangers and having to kind of put yourself on stage.
I have done that as well. I've done it. The scariest karaoke I ever did was in a huge place in Piccadilly Circus in London. And when I put my name down at the start, there were about 10 or 12 people in this bar. And by the time I got on stage, there were about 200. And it was absolutely terrifying walking up to the stage. But I did Hound Dog by Elvis. Wait, not because I'm a big Elvis fan, but just because I find his songs really easy to sing, or that I can do a good Elvis impersonation. And it was quite good. But
I was going to ask you if you had a go-to song or two that you knew on your worst day that you could still, you know, you could still do a pretty good job.
It would be Hound Dog. That's always the first one that I do, because that kind of makes people kind of go, well, it's quite good. And then I'll go on and do loads of other stuff. Yeah, I love singing. I sing all the time. I sing. I write listening to music, and I've just got music on all the time. I mean, apart from books, music is my big passion. So I just love singing. And I guess I like being in front of an audience. I like doing things like festivals and talking about my books and stuff. And being in front of an audience and singing, even though I kind of still get that kind of nervous rush as I start, I really, really enjoy it. So I guess I'm a bit of a show off, really.
So, are you a musician as well?
No, I can't play anything. I've tried and I just can't do it. I can't coordinate my hands.
but you can sing, okay.
Yeah, well, I'm not like a brilliant singer. I'm not like X Factor. I'm not good enough to go on X Factor or something, but I can hold a tune. But please don't ask me to sing now, because it would just be embarrassing.
I will not. Yeah.
Okay.
So one of your jobs was also you'd mentioned you had to pick broad beans. I don't know what broad beans are. what are they and where was that?
I don't know if they would have a different name in America. You know, like you have zucchinis and we have aubergines, and there are various vegetables that have different names in the US and the UK, but I don't know what a broad bean is. It's a little bit like a haricot bean, you know, like but a bit
I'm looking it up online, and I believe it is, we would call it a fava bean.
Okay. Well,
so,
for
those listening, this would be, for Hannibal Lecter, he would be cooking in the census taker's liver with broad beans and a fine Chianti.
I had no idea. Well, that makes that scene in sound much less glamorous now, because a broad bean...
It does, yeah.
It's the kind of thing that only people kind of over 70 eat these days. I've never seen a broad bean on a plate since I did this terrible... I only did it for like 2 or 3 days, and I was basically standing in a fit on a farm in the middle of nowhere, picking beans and putting them in a crate. And then it turned out that the farmer decided at the end of this that the beans that I picked weren't big enough, even though he didn't and wouldn't pay me. So I did all this work and didn't get paid in the end. And I basically stormed off the farm and never went back. That was one of those holiday jobs that I did when I was a student.
Would you say that's the worst job you've had?
No, the worst job I had was working in a food packing factory, which is another job I did as a student, where I was basically, how can I describe it? You wear these kind of overalls with a hat and a hair, because I used to have long hair and I used to have to wear a hair net to stop my hair falling into the cornflakes. And one of the jobs there was sitting on a conveyor belt with loads and loads of like thousands of cornflakes, like Kellogg's cornflakes going past you, picking out the black ones, like the burnt ones, by hand.
Wow.
And
I didn't know that was a job.
Oh my God, the mind numbingness of it. Or putting jellies. This is another weird American British. Jelly for you is like jam, isn't it, for us? They're like little hard sweets. Putting jellies into boxes and picking out the misshapen ones and things like this. It was just horrendous. And I was, like I said, I was a student. I think I was 18 or 19. And I was a goth at this time. So I had like long dyed black hair. And I used to wear eyeliner to work. I was a massive fan of The Cure, you know, like Robert Smith from The Cure.
I used to
try and dress like him. So I used to wear eyeliner to work, which the guy, like these really macho guys in their like 30s and 40s who worked in this factory were kind of disgusted by this young guy wearing makeup coming into their factory. They used to call me horrendous things that I can't even say on the air. Terrible things.
If you wanted to, we are not regulated by the FCC on this show, so you could actually swear all you'd like.
No,
all right.
I got a hard time in this factory, but it was character building, I guess.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because the devil's work is all about horrible work environments, so I wanted to check. And for our American audiences who don't know what jellies is, jellies are also another word for fava beans. It's just cheeky, whatever you want. So I again want to remind everybody, we've been talking to Mark Edwards, and he's about to release, or he's releasing, The Devil's Work. He also is the author of Follow You Home and The Magpies, and several novels where he's co-written with an author named Louise Voss. I guess as we're closing out, I just had a quick question on, you know, what the collaborative process that you had with Louise Voss, how did that work pragmatically? How would you how would you guys end up working together to write a book?
It was, well, we've written 6 books together now, so we kind of over time developed a technique, which is we'd initially get together, discuss the book, kind of work out what it's going to be about and the rough plot. But usually only like the first 15, maybe 20% of the plot, because I never know what's going to happen at the end of my books. And it was the same with the ones with Louise. And then we write a chapter plan, and we write, so we'll go like chapter one, it's this, like a one-line description of what's going to happen in chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, and so on. And then we would just divide it up. And so I'd say to Louise, right, you write chapter three, I'll write chapter five, chapter one, and so on. And because we always have multiple narrators, we would tend to kind of take like a couple of narrators each. But we were writing it all out of order. So I might be working on chapter five while she's working on chapter 11. And then as soon as we finish a chapter, we would send it to the other person to read through and make comments and suggestions and act like an editor, basically. And then we'd have like a master document. And as the chapters were finished, we'd slot them into this master document. So we'd kind of build it as we went along, but not necessarily in order. It wouldn't be like I'd write chapter one, then she'd write chapter two, and so on. It was much more chaotic.
Yeah.
So, but somehow it always works. And then when you get to the end, we edit it in the same way that any author does it. You just go through and find the other problems, and again we divvy up and say, right, I'm gonna tackle these problems and you tackle those problems, and then we'll see where we get to at the end. And it's the best thing about co-writing is that it gives you a sense of freedom, almost like having a safety net or a like a rope attached to you. Because I find that when I'm writing on my own in isolation, I find it hard to know whether what I'm writing is any good or not. Whereas when you've got a co-author and you get that immediate feedback, you can feel whether something's working, whether it isn't. And it kind of makes you feel a bit braver, or you can take more risks because you know that you've got somebody else who's going to stop you kind of going off in the wrong direction or making mistakes. So for me, that is the great, it's not the kind of, it actually takes just as long for us to write one of our books as it does for me to write a book on my own. Even though we're kind of writing at twice the speed we should be.
That makes sense.
It's that sense of freedom that you get from having a creative partner that makes it some, I would recommend it to people to try. The only downside is you only get half the money at the end.
Well, I want to remind everybody we're almost up. I want to remind everybody we've been talking to Mark Edwards. He is the author of several books with Louise Voss and on his own. I'd recommend the new one coming out, The Devil's Work, about work from hell, The Office from Hell, Follow You Home, about a holiday from hell, and The Magpies, about neighbors from hell. And Mark, it's been a pleasure to have you on. If anyone's interested in getting in touch with me, my name is Alex Dolan, and you can always go to www.alexdolan. For folks that are celebrating Christmas, Merry Christmas, everybody. And Mark, so much fun talking to you, and come back whenever you want.
It was lots of fun. Thank you.
All right. All right. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.